Welcome everyone to the Pop Culture Podcast by Fantastic Geek. My name is Matt, and joining me as always is Pete. Hello, Pete.
Hello, Matt. Hello, everybody. Happy holidays. Here today to talk to you about Wonder Woman 1984.
Indeed, Pete, this the unique, although soon to be not as unique, offering on HBO Max, streaming in these United States on the Max, as well as on theater screens, I guess around the country and certainly around the world in this prolonged age of the COVID pandemic.
Yeah, when Warner Brothers back the beginning of the month announced its entire slate for 2021 and Wonder Woman would go to HBO Max day and date, got my attention, got your attention. 31 days they're offering each of those films. So if you haven't checked out Wonder Woman 1984 yet, you've got 29 days left. I watched this Christmas Day. Matt watched this the next day. Talk about our impressions now. Matt, I think maybe the best thing that come out of this is that director and co-screenwriter Patty Jenkins has been rescued from the DC expanded universe and has a Star Wars movie, Rogue Squadron, coming out Christmas 2023. So a promotion, leaving this franchise, leaving the DCEU dribble behind?
I certainly would expect, given the runtime, or not the runtime, but given the lead-up time to do a major studio movie, and with Rogue Squadron having that date circled for 2023, probably this is the last Wonder Woman outing for Patty Jenkins. Never say never, of course, but just kind of doing the math, you know, age of Gal Gadot, general heat to the DCEU or lack thereof. This may be a turning point for Patty Jenkins, but yeah, we certainly have this work of hers to talk about and future works on the radar.
Yeah, and they have actually just finished the treatment for Rogue Squadron. I was unaware her father was a former, fighter pilot. So really, really looking forward to that. I just wish we got a little bit more of that in our Wonder Woman 84. Because, Matt, it took three writers to come up with a bloated genie in a bottle story that 2 hours 30 minutes, I mean, just does not feel like that weighty a tale. And I think the thing, you know, that the original does so well of let's free ourselves of the shackle of the DC murderverse where everything is so heavy. It's not that the original doesn't have weight. It does. I mean, World War One, the Great War. But this just never comes together cohesively.
I think the movie does have some narrative challenges. I will say, just in terms of the context in which it was watched, this, I know that we've had in this pandemic, we've had other movies either move quickly to streaming services or premiere as digital rentals. I'm thinking of Trolls, premiere as digital on the service, Soul as well, premiering on Christmas Day. I just want to take note, since you and I have seen together so many movies in theaters and have podcasted them, just a little mental checklist here, Pete. Number of times that I heard the squeaky recliners at our local Lowe's that somehow took me out of Wonder Woman 1984 was zero. Number of times somebody running up the ramp to get to or from their seat was zero. Number of times somebody took out a phone and took away the darkness of the theater was zero.
The back door being opened and or held open light coming in, shadows coming across the screen, zero numbers of apathetic employees. We had to point to generally filthy conditions, negatory number of patrons needed to be asked to leave the seats that we have registered and confirmed online, nil.
So insofar as this was the first movie I was seeing as kind of intended digital premiere, you know, I saw Trolls opening weekend, my daughter demanded it, and we had the 3-day rental or 2-day rental, whatever it was. And
Matt is making light. He has a Trolls podcast that he doesn't want me on. The Trolls universe. Okay, he does the what is the Trolls? What streamer is their animated show on? Is that Peacock?
It's probably Peacock now. I think it was Netflix.
He won't let me come on it. Okay, he bags on Trolls whenever he can. It's always, oh, my daughter made me watch it. Okay, don't believe a word that he says.
Much of that was not true, but certainly insofar as this was the first. This was the first HBO Max streaming day and date theatrical release thing, which now we are prepared, whether you're going to pay for it or not is a different matter, but we are kind of prepared. You know, it is foretold that the entire Warner Brothers slate will be premiering on HBO Max. Side note, Pete, that may not actually be the case. Mm-hmm. Because
down a rabbit hole on the dates last night, and only like four of them are really affixed to dates, and I could see many of those later dates suddenly being like, hey, yeah, we know we said this, but vaccines and life again and go do things. So yeah, I'm super skeptical of it.
Also, some of the producing partners who actually paid for some of the movies that Warner Brothers is releasing but did not make itself may go to court, or you know, like there's a whole rabbit hole that in terms of the people who actually made the movie, let alone Pete. I hope Patty Jenkins and Gal Gadot and others, I hope that they didn't forego money up front in order to get profit participation, because clearly profit participation, Pete, according to the books, it made no money in your house or my house because you didn't go to the movies for it. You may have had a totally separate HBO Max subscription, but that is not contributing toward the Wonder Woman 1984 theatrical blah blah blah. So guess what, the Hollywood bookkeepers, you know, I was gonna say they get you again, they don't even need to get you, because they can open the book and say, look, here's what the movie did, it was on 384 screens, I'm making that up, but you know, 384 screens in the entire US, and those were drive-ins and so on and so on. But
it is a 2020 problem and, you know, partial solution. I mean, I really feel for writers, producers, directors in that, yeah, the creative math of Hollywood is going to strike again. I'm sure we'll see tomorrow. Okay, you know, judging from social media metrics, it's estimated, you know, this many people saw it. If you equated that to a $15 ticket, you know, what did they do? I'm sure HBO Max, Warner's will be out in front of that as well. I mean, Matt, remember the hundreds of millions of people that saw Bird Box the weekend it came out?
Yeah, you're referring to the funny accounting that Netflix does, which, Pete, anytime we bring it up, I always say, I'm surprised that accounting, I mean, it's one thing in a PR release or in a tweet to say something. I'm surprised that securities and exchange people, the finance people, don't take umbrage with that, because, yes, you're absolutely right. Like, 200 million, 150 million people in the United States supposedly saw Bird Box on the opening weekend, which equates to, you know, like something like five times the amount of people in the on the globe that saw Avengers Endgame. Like, that conversation was not going on in many homes. Did you see Bird Box? Of course I saw. I couldn't get Bird Box tickets for, you know, I couldn't see it on Friday because of my schedule, but Saturday, like, there's some weird things going on here. But Pete, let's take it back to this movie here that opens with a solution to a story problem. And I don't mean story problem as a negative. I think 5 years ago it made sense because of the agelessness of the Wonder Woman character. And I don't mean kind of the character in comics. I mean the character in her real world being ageless. To do a flashback story, perhaps somewhat akin to Captain America, the First Avenger. But that kind of template to take us into her past. And then in the first movie, much loss and so on and so forth. You need to somehow get back to that. Those are great characters. That's a foundation for the character. And to go further back in time to young Diana, you get the return of her mother, some of the other people there, and just a really fun, colorful intro. Pete, this was the first of many times that my wife said, at least they were able to use colors in this one, you know, like in those Justice League movies. Pete, this unprompted. I don't know that she knows who Zack Snyder is. I don't know that she knows.
She doesn't know that. I mean, 2021, Matt, most people will get the vaccine, but, you know, it's because of Zack Snyder, right?
Pete, listen, I've heard that it should be called the Zaxine. Because all you need to do, I won't even make a joke about misinformation in terms of if you watch Justice League, that makes everything okay. But Pete, as I'm wont to point out on social media, when you look at the poster for Zack Snyder's Justice League, the two biggest words there are Zack and Snyder, not Justice League, not DC. So yeah, but Pete, Zack Snyder only nominally a producer on this movie.
Yeah. And maybe proof of it is what it is. The opening scene is great. Young Diana, you know, against all these other women, taking the lead, holding her own. And then, as we discussed off mic beforehand, it's not a metaphor for the film. It's not like this film is suddenly ripped from greatness, you know, as it's about to cross the finish line. But boy, if it isn't some kind of omen that, all right, you saw the best part, or the second best part.
Yeah. It does walk away with the lesson that, you know, that cheaters can't win. And I think that we can only see this movie through the lens of 2020. And Pete, I will constantly try and not apply 2020 lessons to a movie that wrapped filming 2 years ago. Wrapped filming on December 22nd, 2018. Did have some additional filming the following summer. But insofar as I can only see it through the lens of the now, the simple message of reject cheating, it seems a bit antiquated, although certainly the heart is in the right place.
Prescient, I would say here. And, you know, that you have that, and Robin Wright in that scene, really in two portions of it, only time she shows up, again, through virtue of the flashback, the same with Diana's mother, but setting the stage for the rest of the film. Okay, we've got the golden goddess that will become important later on, but gives way to a mall sequence that, you know, at times plays high with the aspirational, you know, the little girls seeing Wonder Woman do her thing, which is great, and then the absolute absurdity of we're robbing a jewelry store and there are really, you know, MacGuffin artifacts back there, and each of the robbers is trying to tell the other robber not to do the wrong thing. No, don't throw the baby. And then I run from the heroine. It's a microcosm of this movie. I've seen people compare this film unfavorably to Superman 2 and to Superman 3. I don't quite see or believe those comparisons, but yeah, the mall sequence I think is a microcosm of the film as a whole.
Certainly there's a fun energy to it. And I think the holding off of seeing Wonder Woman's face and seeing kind of the full reveal, I think we're seeing some of the best work, the best tools out of the toolbox of Patty Jenkins, just in terms of the use of space, the use of color, certainly, and that great kind of mall atrium and whatnot. It's a reminder that though perhaps the screenplay by Jenkins and the former head of everything DC EU film, Geoff Johns, now relegated several levels out of the picture, and also the product of screenwriter David Callum, I think there you see the weaknesses, but it's not in the direction and certainly not in how this scene is visually presented.
No, and if anything, I think Jenkins deserves more credit for ushering, you know, something to the screen that I think on the page is nowhere near as serviceable. And again, I'm super excited for her Star Wars outing. And, you know, I think that will be a relative no-brainer. Not even quite understanding, all right, treatment, is she in there on a screenwriter? Is it just the type of thing where the director is involved? But yeah, I mean, this scene and what it brings you, you're like, okay, yeah, energy and the character and the identification and everything there. And you know, what follows gets increasingly limp. The idea that Diana, who has lived now into the 1980s, having lost her love of her life so many years before, okay, 60, 70 years before, still holding people at arm's length. Obviously, this is before she meets Bruce Wayne, she meets Superman, set more towards our current time. But yeah, we get to this point, and Matt, I think one of the biggest questions raised is, how do you have a movie set in the 1980s that takes advantage of all of the costuming, okay, and the makeup, but none of the music? I mean, have you seen Captain Marvel? Because I know one of the many things I love about Captain Marvel is its soundtrack. And, you know, when they went to the thing here and, you know, dude bros are coming up to Diana and they ask her, hey, do you want a Wang Chung tonight?
You know, it's funny, Pete. The movie looks like it takes place in the 1980s, at least in terms of the costuming and things like that. I don't know if the cinematographer Matthew Jensen is making any 80s type choices. My eye is good; it's not that good to know what 80s type camera work looks like. Side note, Pete, we've now seen all of the work that cinematographer Matthew Jensen has released in the year 2020, because he spent most of last year doing 3 episodes of The Mandalorian to make up his entire year's worth of work. But I digress. You're absolutely right about the music. In fact, as you were talking, I was thinking, which feels more like it takes place in the 1980s, Stranger Things or this movie? And this movie, they dress up like it's the 1980s. And to be fair, the whole Chris Pine sequence in a little bit with the clothing montage, that's a well-earned bit of fun, and well-earned, you know, kind of poking fun at the 1980s style and whatnot. But Pete, I think you're right. It is the lack of music.
How do you not do that? Are you not able to clear a couple, songs from the 80s? Like, Really? Warner Brothers trying to rub nickels together to not do that? Like, that was baffling.
I know this, Pete. When we get the entrance of Pedro Pascal initially by way of TV, then getting to know the character proper, I mean, he's hamming it up there. He clearly is having a ton of fun. And I think that his presence, and we'll talk about Kristen Wiig in a little bit, but his presence hammers home a curious decision that the movie makes, which is we know why Diana is not somebody who's changing much through life because of her agelessness. And I get that, and that's fine. Many heroic characters aren't necessarily on an arc of change. Now you might say, well, historically, traditionally, yes, of course they are, but you know, is Superman that different from movie to movie? Is Batman, you know, minus wife and child, does Iron Man change that much from the end, from I Am Iron Man? Does he change that much until the beginning of Endgame? You know, not really. But when you contrast Wonder Woman against Max Lord, the character of Max Lord, who has these, as we learn throughout the movie, has these humble beginnings, things that we can absolutely sympathize with, and even in his initial, I believe it's his initial on-screen reveal, as opposed to him on the TVs, but this idea of, oh my goodness, all this opulence, and through the visual medium of film, not through dialogue, when, you know, it's this great atrium, and he goes all the way up, and then you say, wait, why is the main trading floor here so empty? Oh wait, He's kind of telling a lie. He's trying to fake it till he makes it. That's all sympathetic to us, right? We're supposed to not like Darth Vader because he's instantly the villain the entire time. We are fearful of Jaws because the first time we see Jaws, he makes that nice lady into multiple pieces. I suppose he or she, Pete. I will not assign gender to the shark in Jaws. But my point being, Max Lord is one of the most sympathetic movie villains, certainly in the comics movie genre, and right by him on the list is Kristen Wiig's character of Dr. Minerva. Pete, I will say this, I stand by her having the title of Doctor, okay? That much I know.
I mean, she's in the movie sometimes. You're right about Pascal, and he leans into the way that the character is written, this lifestyles of the rich and famous Robin Leach type. The Emperor really has no clothes. I mean, it's a great reveal when you get to the office and it looks bombed out before he's ripping people off from their wishes, monkey paw style later on. But with Wiig, I feel like, okay, we have her show up and, you know, she's a sympathetic case as well, but that never really comes around in a powerful way. And I feel that the film just goes such in a film that is as long as this one is. I mean, this story does not require 2.5 hours of screen time. And you want to tell me that 10 minutes at the end or credits, whatever, I wasn't, other than sitting through to get to the post-credit scene, which was actually inadvertent by the time I got to it. It was just like sitting there and credits are rolling for like 3 minutes and then, oh, all right, here's the thing. But yeah, I mean, she is absent for such long stretches of the film that you're reminded, like, oh, she's in this, and now she's got nicer shoes and a better hairstyle.
But I think even in that presentation, again, Dr. Minerva's character is so incredibly sympathetic. Yes, I didn't fully buy in the beginning where it's like, what, Kristen Wiig in her, you know, kind of Hollywood female figure, you know, kind of thin and not an extra ounce of fat and whatnot, you know, oh my goodness, people never thought that she was attractive. Like, I'll grant the movie that little that right. little conceit.
Oh, she
there.
Has big glasses. I understand.
Right. But again, I'll grant the movie that conceit because it other alternatives like, hey, Kristen Wiig, can you put on 30 pounds for the beginning of the movie and then slowly lose it? Like, that's unnecessary. And hey, Kristen Wiig, can you put on a suit or like, these are all dumb conclusions. You can just say, oh, she's kind of not one of those people who's not noticed in life. But point being, that's so sympathetic. Like, she's got all these qualifications. The person who hired her doesn't remember her. She's that mousy person who could speak up more but doesn't want to rock the boat. And these are all reasons to like her, but she's one of the villains. And as she gets more and more of the power, like, maybe the meta commentary is supposed to be any one of us could you know, kind of fall into the trap and embrace the darkness and be selfish and things like that. And absolutely, give me the powers of Cheetah. That would be fantastic. But it doesn't make me... Again, when it's contrasted with an unchanging Wonder Woman, and you have these two characters who are on very sympathetic arcs, you know, I'm even down to, you know, the scene in which the drunk is... pawing it at Kristen Wiig and right. first she needs the help to protect herself and then she gets the power. That's all wonderful, but it's her on a dark path as she learns to, you know, like Pete, I don't think anybody's worried about drunk guy getting the snot beat out of him, you know, within the context of the movie, he had it coming, you know, in the real world, maybe that's less clear, but we all had fun having him, seeing him get knocked around. Albeit with the dark notes there, but it's like it's in service of us feeling sympathetic for the second villain in the movie.
Yeah, and I don't think they have a villain problem so much as they have a MacGuffin problem. And this is maybe the dumbest MacGuffin. I mean, I'm struggling to think of something that is as stupid as this. I mean, before I checked it out, had a friend text me, you know, really did not like it, and you know, I don't care, you tell me spoilers ahead of time, and told me that you know, Pedro Pascal literally wishes himself into a stone. And it's that bad. Apart from the, oh, it's fake, no, it was really real, which is also dumb, or to use the phrase from the film, lame. And then, hey Matt, how does Steve Trevor come back?
Pete, Steve Trevor comes back for the same reason that Chris Pine comes back. I think the people behind the first Wonder Woman movie had a lot of wishes that they made different narrative choices with the first movie. Not even the first movie in terms of its overall structure. But I think, in retrospect, the desire to have modern-day Wonder Woman reflect back on these things, and then that's a story that is the past and is going to stay in the past, that left them handcuffed versus... They wished to have Chris Pine back. They realized, perhaps, as this movie kind of sorted itself out, that the two villains were, you know, essentially it was, the two villains essentially are kind of, it's like the first couple Batman movies, where the first villain is icon for the ages, Jack Nicholson, playing Jack Nicholson in Joker makeup, Jack Nicholson. Also Michael Keaton appears. And that's a balance that works. Then in the next movie, okay, we can up the Batman stuff and we can up the Bruce Wayne stuff, but we need to equal Jack Nicholson. So the legendary Danny DeVito and the shining Michelle Pfeiffer will almost equal Jack Nicholson. But the point being, in relation here to Wonder Woman 1984, you have these two really interesting villains. What are we going to do to add shine to Diana? Well, bring Steve Trevor back. The wish stone makes it possible because that's her wish. I think the movie wished, ultimately, if you didn't kill him in the first one, then you could have done 5 years later, during the 1920s. That's, then you could just have him back and still have it as a period piece, and maybe still have, you know, old timey cheetah, and you know, like all the elements could be the same, just transpose the time. But you killed him off. Why does he come back? Because they wish that they didn't kill him off.
And he's in another guy's body that he can see, yet she can see him. And I think, you know, for the character of Wonder Woman, Diana Prince, to predicate her existence, fulfillment, on a male deceased character. And look, she learns that, and he frees her of that. But I just don't think it's the lesson, the takeaway we want or need. And just in the same way that in this film, Wonder Woman can fly, but she does not fly in Batman versus Superman. I'm not going to say the whole name, or Justice League, at least Justice League 1, not the 4-hour miniseries Justice League, where she probably flies alongside Batman and then he says the F word. Because he can't fly.
And you know, it's funny, because of, by way of talking about her flight, and we'll talk a little bit, I suppose, now about the fireworks scene and the invisible jet, because of the nature of the Dreamstone, it had this weird dissonance with the rest of the movie, and I'll tell you why. I know how the Dreamstone works because they show it to us, and fine, it's this ancient like, I completely buy the magic of it. It's ostensibly taking place, this movie is ostensibly taking place in, you know, the real world, or the DC version of the real world, but it's as real as it gets. But there's this ancient stone from the ancient times that has magic powers. Totally buy it. Totally understand it.
People have
it.
To say wish, and I have to touch you when we do that, which becomes increasingly silly to predicate the story moving forward on. Oh, how can I touch the most people? Don't you wish I could do that?
Yes, perhaps it gets a little tripped up in its own rules, but I understand the rules. However, once we have Steve Trevor returning, and particularly some of the scenes surrounding him seeing the plane fly over the National Mall, I said to myself, I know that that's not a flight path that the plane would take, just because I know where the National Mall is in relation to the Capitol building and the White House, and I doubt that that's an open air corridor. Then I said to myself, hold on, relax. This is not a documentary.
Man, it was excess.
Yeah, I mean, my point being, I wag my finger at that, and then the magic reveal, which this movie is not the first to do, the magic reveal that out back behind the National Air and Space Museum is the other annex building that has all these things, which is a real building that's like an hour away. It's like, I initially got caught up in that, and I'm like, no, I'm being unfair, just let it go. And then when they wander on into a museum jet that's loaded up and ready to take off and takes off, again, I'm saying, this is completely, this is adding unrealistic to unrealistic, but somehow, here's my point, Pete. The dissonance is this. I'm mentally complaining about the logistics of some of the plane stuff in a movie that also has me believing 1,000% that the Dreamstone exists. It gives these wishes. It takes something back. You need to touch it. You need to say wish. I totally buy that. The fact that to get the awesome invisible jet moment, the iconic invisible jet, if something that can be unseen is also an icon, to get that involves an ancient magic of old. I totally believe that. While I'm simultaneously blown away by the visual beauty of flying through the fireworks, while I am simultaneously saying it can't be good for a jet engine to fly through fireworks. Again, there's this weird push-pull that's going on that I don't think is me being pedantic. I don't think that it's me being grumpy. I certainly don't think, as I've seen leveled online, thank goodness not to us, but in general, you know, like the generalizations, men hate Captain Marvel because she's powerful. Men hate Wonder Woman because she's powerful. I don't think, first of all, I would argue painting anybody with such a general brush there, but I don't think I'm bringing any gender or seasonal or 2020 or pandemic or seasonal affective disorder or any other biases to this movie to just say it had me thinking, had me okay with magic, but not okay with jet intake pipes or whatever it is, jet intake fans at the same time.
I'm here to tell you as a yet unproduced screenwriter, there's a million and one ways to get Diana into the invisible jet over fireworks for the most luminous scene of the movie. Okay. But then by the time you're at the motivational speech climax in nonsensical location that can beam particles through the TV everywhere. I mean, it is a mix of it aims to be, you know, the metaphor I'll use here is the president's speech from Independence Day and the Wonka vision beaming, you know, touchy particles everywhere. And you can be a better dad. You can do it. It's just so silly. And a fight with the cheetah lady. It's the rub on DCEU films is that the climax devolves into nearly complete CGI messes. Okay. Batman versus Superman, Man of Steel, Justice League being the greatest at totally not Chernobyl, Russia, with four human beings who are not super people. Okay. So there's real stakes, Matt. There's real stakes. Okay. Wonder Woman, the first, falls victim to that as well. This, to a lesser extent, they've heard the criticism, let's not do that. Yet again, the stakes just don't feel big enough or right enough.
I will add to it now some 2020 bias, and this, I want to make it very clear, this is not a criticism of the film as much as perhaps it's a criticism of me, which is to say this. The earnestness with which the solution to the problem is, everybody, open your eyes to the truth, be selfless, stop being selfish. The heart is in its right place. At the end of this year, I just can't muster acceptance of it. I'll use as one example, and this could be an example of any of the montage of people that we saw who made wishes. Guy who wishes, you know, wishes curtains for his lady love there. He or anybody else, all it takes is one just to be like, nah, actually I meant it. I'm going to be selfish. And again, to me, that's a very 2020 look. When this movie was completed 2 years ago, I know there were certain corners of our world that were just as challenged as they are now, but I just think, Pete, I'm bringing to it an exhaustion and a lack of reliance on the goodness of the goodness of all humanity to make the right decision. I will add, for whatever it's worth, when the climax of the movie was fully revealed and, you know, people were renouncing their wishes, my wife was like, "That's it? That's the solution?"
So, and that's the thing. It's underwhelming. Matt, I do not renounce my wish in that I wanted the movie to end. In fact, it took too long to come true.
Yeah, and in fact, I'm seeing here a Patty Jenkins, it's not a quote, but it's a reference to an interview that she did, which essentially says, though she has ideas for a third movie, she doubts whether she wants to make it in the current world state. So
because
I think there's
Lucasfilm backed up the truck and said, hey, Wonder Woman, gotten buzz on the second movie that's not quite out yet. Hey, here's a dump truck filled with money. Come do the passion project thing. Okay, you've made hay with the Wonder Woman. You've done it under pressure. Now, hey, do this thing that's super close to your heart that I don't have a doubt in my mind she's going to execute with aplomb. And I also have zero worries about Dreamstones.
Pete, the entirety of the movie, my wife was saying, where's Linda Carter? Where's Linda Carter?
I was thinking the same exact thing. And thank goodness at least that pays off. But in a post-credit scene, I feel you're selling her short. And she's so important to Wonder Woman in general. I mean, it's not Stan Lee, okay? It's not, I think, Lou Ferrigno to a lesser extent. But Lou Ferrigno gets his scene in the body of the narrative.
Well, and also, I mean, it's great to see Linda Carter. It's great that the series is now on HBO Max as well, so you can check that out. I feel like to save her for the post-credit sequence, that was wonderful. That was cute. That was fantastic. I suspected that perhaps we were seeing her eyes in the scenes of Asteria, battling the men of the world, that sort of thing. I feel like you could have had Linda Carter's face in those scenes of old, and still would have been a great moment. And then if you still had the exact same post-credit sequence where there she is in the then modern world of 1984, it lends itself to zing for the future. You know, oh, will she show up in the third one, or apparently there's going to be a spinoff, or you know, things of that sort, versus just hey, we had her show up at the end. Because I've heard in these movies you do a post-credit sequence that's really great and fan friendly, so you do it with her, right? As opposed to what we've seen in the evolution from Marvel, where it's always for a story purpose. Like, either it's set up for the next movie, or it's a chuckle. It's one look back at this one. I think of, you know, the ant playing drums at the end of Ant-Man and the Wasp, where it doesn't move the story forward, although it actually kind of does, because you see, you know, the emergent state that the world is in before you get one last chuckle. So overall, Pete, we were glad to see Linda Carter. It was just perhaps not the best execution of it.
And I think that's what this film boils down to. It's misuse. That you have Gal Gadot, and you know, the challenge the film goes through to try to make it believable that she's losing her powers, that she's vulnerable, and now, Matt, we will make her hair frizzy. Now we will truly make her unattractive. Her hair will become frizzed. Maybe, you know, one of the greatest fears of the 1980s, having lived through it, you know, as a child, but like, really? And yeah, to wait until the end, I get it. You want to give it some weight. You want to give her the feature limelight she rightly deserves. Could you have integrated that scene, I don't know, when they were in the Middle Eastern setting tonally? Might it have been off? I get that as well. We got her. I just think, again, there's a greater, better use for so many of the things in this film. And, you know, forget a four-hour cut of a really bad two-hour movie, as if that's going to make it better, right? Okay. How about a 90-minute cut of a two-and-a-half-hour movie? There's one there. Like, we enjoyed the heck out of Aquaman and Shazam, both, you know, a little shorter. I mean, certainly Aquaman is longer than Shazam, But, you know, in to my mind, their three best films are the original Wonder Woman, Aquaman, and Shazam to a lesser extent. That show they've learned, that show they've reacted. And instead, the fans clamor, Matt, for 4 hours of the worst film that they've done thus far.
Well, yes, the Snyder Cut will be interesting. And I know, Pete, you got to get butts in the seats for people to see any of this stuff. And insofar as Wonder Woman 1984 was the first step in that direction for HBO Max and Warner Brothers and making it this, you know, destination, I know that we're on board basically for all of 2021. We definitely will watch the Snyder Cut miniseries and podcast it along with, I mean, just looking at this Warner Brothers schedule that at this moment, the following movies, or at least some of these movies, will definitely be podcasting. I mean, Matrix 4, I
don't think Matrix 4 will make HBO Max, at least this way, because next December, and I mean, we've seen, other than some filming, we've seen zilch to that film. And I went down the rabbit hole, like I said, last night, looking into the release schedule. Matt, that cast list is bonkers, okay? Do you know that Doogie Howser is in Matrix 4?
I did not know that.
Okay, like, that's bonkers, all right? Jessica Hennick, Matt, is in Matrix 4, okay? Colleen Wing, all right? That alone sold me on that film, okay? Forget the fact that, all right, Keanu's back, and, you know, if you understand anything, it can't be his story. He's now Obi-Wan Kenobi. He's now essentially Morpheus, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. But, you know, I'm really, really looking forward to that. And I think once there's footage from it out, a lot of other people, not even on their radar yet, will be. And Warner Brothers will be like, yeah, I know we said a lot of people watched Wonder Woman 1984, and it was a kind of a win for us on Christmas Day, everybody who didn't make Soul. But, yeah, I do not foresee a path for them to put that in both places simultaneously. And I think they're going to recant on that under, hey, you got your vaccine, so get back into your filthy AMC. Oops, AMC is out of business, except for major urban centers.
Add to the potential list, Dune, In the Heights, The Suicide Squad. Pete, I wouldn't rule out us checking out for podcast purposes, Mortal Kombat. You know, it's...
The Sopranos prequel is, like, at the top of my list, and thankfully that's one of the earlier releases. I mean, that was supposed to be out in September, originally, 2020. But yeah, I mean, there's value added with that. It's going to remain to be seen. Like, I already pay for HBO, and that's why I have this. And, you know, I imagine, though Matt's on a different cable system, it's a similar situation. Would I have paid for this? Yes, knowing that I will indeed get all those. The minute I find out that that's not going to be the case, that's value subtracted. So this great experiment, and we were positing at the time prior to the Disney Investor Day, okay, like, what does the mouse do? All right, Black Widow coming at such a time, and I think there remains a plan C with Black Widow. Oh, wait, hey, we've got 25% vaccination rate here in the continental United States. So 2 weeks after the theatrical window, because I'm not running into a theater unvaccinated just to see Black Widow. Matt's not. But I'll pay to watch that on Disney Plus, similar to Mulan, or do they just unlock it and curry that goodwill in a year where Marvel's going to have four scheduled releases for the first time, obviously backed up because of 2020. But yeah, I think that to ponder this experiment, the jury's out. And okay, this was a tentpole release, super overdue to try it for. And again, you curry that good favor. And I know there were people who enjoyed it. And I'm happy that people truly enjoyed it. I like things about it. But overall, this was not the film to start them off. This was not the Mandalorian, Matt, to start off Disney Plus for this experiment. Now, can you always hit a Grand Slam home run to start? You can't. Could you at least gauge, like, all right, this is the film with which to do this? You weren't going to do it with the Denzel Washington movie next month. You know, it's a different vibe. But, yeah.
Certainly, Pete, in the meantime, between now and podcasting some of these other Warner Brothers releases on HBO Max, we, of course, have both of our Mandalorian seasons completely covered on the Mandalorian podcast feed. We are headed towards the end of Season 3 for Star Trek Discovery. And before you know it, we're going to be talking WandaVision, doing a preview podcast for that. Indeed, Pete, news on that front, which I won't tease here, but news on that front in terms of potential schedule changes for WandaVision, even as the show starts in about 3 weeks' time.
Yeah, January 15th, Friday the 15th there, the first episode dropping. Matt and I still haven't decided. Are we going to do Saturdays? Are we going to do Sundays? Maybe Marvel Mondays? Give people a chance to get their feedback in. We're going to have that conversation as we prepare to record our wrap for Season 2 of Mandalorian right after this podcast. But yeah, lots more to listen to. Lots more coming. Fantastic Geek. We can't surpass what we gave you in 2019, and maybe that's the most 2020 thing ever. 185 podcasts in 2019, just a shade over 100 in 2020, and it's not for a lack of availability.
Pete, how can people be in touch with you to share their thoughts about this movie, the upcoming Warner Brothers slate, etc.?
You can find me on Twitter at Peter, PIETERJKETELAR, KETELAAR, 11,732 followers.
And while I'm personally on Twitter's Looking Back Lost, do be in touch with the podcast, comment on FantasticGeek.com. Check us out on Twitter, Instagram, Gmail, where we are Fantastic Geek as well. But wait, Pete, there's more.
Facebook.com/FantasticGeek, all one word, with the P and the H, like it today.
Pete can't wait to hit the next thing on the Pop Culture Podcast feed, which I suspect is going to be Mandalorian. With that, I will say adios to all our listeners and give you the final word.
I wish this movie was better.